Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's November 19th. We're going to finish up the heart today and move on to vascular system. Does anybody have any questions? It's a nice week because there's no practicums this week. No lecture exams this week. Just a week to enjoy studying. That's nice. All right. So, let me turn just a couple of these lights down. Probably this one here, that one there, just like that. How's that? Is that good? Okay, so the heart, how many hearts do you have?
One.
One, all right. How many sides to the heart do you have?
Two.
Two. Now, why do you have two sides of the heart?
Two different
circulations. Yeah, because there are two different circulations, so you should make that connection. And does anybody remember what the two circulations are? The pulmonary circulation and systemic circulation. Oh, you guys are doing really good. Okay, so the heart is a pump. It pumps blood. But it's a misnomer to think that it's just one pump. It's actually two pumps side by side. Right? There's a left pump and a right pump. The left pump pumps blood through the systemic circulation and the right pump pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation. So there are actually two pumps. Okay, so chambers are the things inside of a heart that pump blood. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Yeah, there are four. And blood should only flow in one direction through the heart. And what makes sure that blood only flows in one direction through the heart? Valves. How many valves are there? Yeah, the same number as chambers. All right, so you should know the names of all the chambers, all the valves, the blood flow pattern through the heart. And I think I drew that on the board for you. And we should also know, let's just go over a definition is going to be very important. What's a definition of an artery? Yes, it's just by looking at the flow of blood, and it's flow of blood away from the heart, and it can be relatively high in oxygen or relatively low in oxygen. It all depends. Okay, so could anybody give me the name of an artery that is relatively high in oxygen? Relatively high in oxygen. That's going to be the aorta, because it's taking blood to the systemic circulation. But there's an artery that's relatively low in oxygen. What's the name of an artery low in oxygen? That is the pulmonary artery or pulmonary trunk. It takes blood away from the heart, and where is it taking blood to? The lungs, where the blood can pick up oxygen and get rid of CO2. So by knowing oxygen and CO2 is not a good way to understand the definition for an artery or a vein. An artery just takes blood away from the heart, and a vein returns it to the heart. All right, so here you see the two circulations. I'm not sure I mentioned this before, but the heart also has two phases. Not only does it have two sides, right and left, it has two phases of contraction. So this is more of a physiological rather than anatomic understanding. Okay, and I see the two phases right here, right above the arrow, right above the cursor. What are the two heart phases? They're called systole, and the second one is diastole. That's how it's pronounced. Okay, systole is when the heart is contracting. But the heart is not like an electric pump. An electric pump can pump fluids all the time, but the heart only pumps during systole. So it can pump blood when it's contracting. And then the second heart phase is relaxation. We call that diastole. All right, and the blood pressure in your veins doesn't go to zero between systole and diastole. And that's why when you get your blood pressure measured, they don't just give you one number. They give you two numbers. One corresponding to the peak pressure, which is developed during systole. And then the lower pressure is a pressure when the heart is relaxed. We call that diastolic pressure. So that's why you get two numbers when somebody tells you what your blood pressure is. And we used to think that systole was the most important phase of the heart cycle, and indeed it is very important because it tells us how blood is being pumped, but it's also important to know something about diastole and how the heart relaxes. When the heart relaxes, the chambers dilate. And guess what can happen when the chambers dilate? they fill with blood. So if the chambers don't dilate, they don't fill with blood, so maybe the heart will contract with a lot of vigor and a lot of strength, but if there's no blood in the chambers, then it's not going to be able to pump blood. So both phases of the heart are very important, and they have to be behaving properly. So there's proper systolic function and proper diastolic function of the heart. So both of those you're going to be really interested in when you get to a physiology class. Okay, so that's pretty much a review from last time. And so let's move on with what we want to talk about today. We talked about the fibrous skeleton already. Well, we're going to start talking about the electrical properties of heart muscle. And I see the slide on the right shows a nice light micrograph of heart muscle. And how could you recognize this to be heart muscle? What are some of the nice dead giveaways when I look at this picture right here? I see striations. Okay, I do see striations, which means what? What's the contractile unit inside heart muscle? Because when one of these things ends here, it begins over here. And when it ends there, it begins over here. And where it ends there, it begins over here. Sarcomere, that's right. The sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction in skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. So don't forget how sarcomeres are all put together with different kinds of myofilaments. Who can tell me the name of a myofilament? Actin is one. What's another one? Myosin. Great. And some of these are thick and some are thin. Which is the thick one? Myosin. And the thin one is actin. That's right. And that's what gives this striated appearance within these different kinds of muscle cells. Now, I know this is muscle cell also because it's a relatively short cell. I see the end of one cell here and it goes over to here. Very short, unlike a skeletal muscle, which is really long. Cardiac muscle only has one nucleus in it because it's not a very big cell. So here is a cell that begins over here and it ends right here again, another very short cell. And in order for the heart to contract, the whole heart, or to pump blood, in order for the heart to pump blood, the heart has to contract as a unit. And there's something, right, between cells that allows the heart to contract as a unit, as if it was just one muscle cell. And it is these gap junctions right here. All right, so when a chemical flows through a gap junction, changing the electrical properties of that neighboring cell, then this cell will contract. And that signal will flow through these gap junctions into the next neighboring cell, will cause this cell to contract, almost at the exact same time. All right, so all we have to do is stimulate one cell, and every cell from right to left is going to contract because that electrical signal can get through the gap junctions. In physiology, you'll see what that signal is. All right, but what else can happen because of the structure of a myocardial cell? Not only are they connected together right to left, but also from top to bottom because of these branches, the branching pattern that is exhibited by myocardial cells. So an electrical signal not only travels through the whole heart from right to left, but also from top to bottom all the way through the wall of the heart. So all of the cells contract. Okay, and you should know what that little junction is between cells that allows for it to be controlled all by the same electrical signal. That is a gap junction, and a gap junction is a component that is found in the structure that's observed under a light microscope, and that's called an intercalated disc. All right. Other structures in the intercalated disc to make sure that the myocardial cells don't pull apart from each other, because they're going to want to shorten and pull apart from each other, are these adherens junctions. So the intercalated disc is a pretty complicated structure that makes sure that the cells are glued together so they don't come apart because of the adherens junctions. But they're also electrically connected due to these gap junctions right here. Okay, so the heart is an interesting muscle, unlike skeletal muscle, that needs a command from your brain to contract. Okay, and if it doesn't get a command to contract, then a muscle just won't contract until you tell it to contract. That's why we call it voluntary muscle. The heart muscle, on the other hand, will contract all on its own, even though it's not connected to your brain. Just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, if somebody were to rip your heart out of your chest and put it on the table, it would actually beat without being connected to your brain. So let's see why that is. Okay, and that's because of the nodal tissue within inside the heart. So here we see a nice heart, and let's review this real quick. What part of the heart is this here?
Apex,
nice. And what part is here? The base, that's right. And then we can't see the third thing that I want you to know in lab. Does anybody remember what the third thing is? It is the anterior longitudinal sulcus. And if you know those three things, you know everything about the heart. So those are the three things we're going to key on in lab. But here we have a nice coronal section of the heart, and we can see both atria, the right and left atrium, and the right and left ventricle. And in gold, we see some specially modified myocardial cells. So these are not neurons. These are actual muscle cells that are specialized to transmit electrical information. And this part of the right atrium that we call the sinoatrial node will spontaneously develop electrical impulses that will trigger the whole heart to contract. And so we call this the SA node, or the pacemaker of the heart. So the pacemaker of the heart controls the heart rhythm. It is controlled by nerves. You have the sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system go to the SA node. What can you tell me about sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? Okay, fight or flight response for sympathetic. What about parasympathetic? Rest and digest. So if we put both these together, what do we get? We get the autonomic nervous system, right? The autonomic nervous system. All right, so the SA node is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, both the sympathetic and parasympathetic. The parasympathetic nervous system slows the heart rate down. The sympathetic can speed it up. And it's the heart is always figuring out what the balance is between those two different nervous systems. Right? But without innervation, the heart will contract all by itself anyway. The nerves just can influence the heart rate. So first there is an electrical signal that develops in the SA node, and it moves through all those myocardial cells because they have gap junctions through both atria. That electrical signal causes both atria to contract. So it pumps blood. Where do the atria pump blood? Past the atrioventricular valve into the ventricle. So the atria help fill the ventricles a little bit. Okay. But remember, in this junction between the atria and ventricles, there's the fibrous skeleton. And electrical signals can't get through the fibrous skeleton because it's just like a tendon. It's just dense, regular connective tissue. No electrical properties whatsoever. So there's got to be a special way for electrical signals to go from an atrium into the ventricle, and here it is. There are some specialized muscle cells called the atrioventricular node. It's right at the junction between the atria and ventricles. When it receives that electrical impulse from the SA node, it holds on to it for just a little bit, acts as a little bit of a delay, and then it sends it through the fibrous skeleton into the ventricles. All right, so this is what we call the AV node, and then this pathway into the ventricles is what we call the atrioventricular bundle through the fibrous skeleton. So this is carrying electrical information. All right, and then very rapidly it moves down these two pathways. All right, so we call these the bundle branches, right and left bundle branches on the heart. Brings that electrical activity very fast down to the apex of the heart and passes it out through these Purkinje fibers, and that stimulates the apex of the heart to contract, which then stimulates a little bit more proximal regions of the heart to contract, and then the more basal regions of the heart to contract. Right? And then finally, the whole heart is contracted as a unit because of the way it was excited from an electrical signal starting at the SA node. So I do want you to know this SA node, the AV node, right, the bundle, the atrioventricular bundle and the bundle branches and the Purkinje fibers right here control the speed and how the heart contracts as a nice unit. Okay, and since the apex apical regions of the heart contract just a little bit before the basal regions, which way does that force blood? From the apex up into the base of the heart and out the great arteries, like the aorta that we see right here and the pulmonary artery that's been cut off of this illustration, which comes from the right ventricle. Okay, so the conduction system is very important for controlling the heart. If this SA node becomes damaged, right? Then another part of the heart becomes the pacemaker, but at a slower rate. So somebody's heart won't beat fast enough, for instance, when they get up and start to walk around, or maybe if they start to exercise, right? So they need a little electronic assist. Does anybody know what that's called when somebody's heart rate is too slow because of damage to the SA node right here? That's called a pacemaker. And indeed, that's what it is. So that's the wires are put right into the atrium here, and this little box is inserted into the chest, and people do fine with that. They can even play sports with that. I don't know if they'd want to play tackle football, but they can play all kinds of sports as a result. They can have a pretty normal life. Okay, so that is the conduction of the system of the heart, nodal cells. Okay, then we have these conducting cells. Here's a condition that we call fibrillation. Right? All of these cells, since they have gap junctions, if we stimulate the heart, where I have the cursor right now, just in the wall of the left ventricle, because of gap junctions, that electrical signal will flow through the whole myocardium. Okay, but not in the usual manner, not using the normal conduction system. And when that happens, this part of the heart will contract first, and then if that electrical signal comes over here, then this part of the heart will contract, and then if that electrical signal then bounces down to here, then the apical region will contract, and then it can bounce up to here, and the septal region can contract. All right, and when that happens, instead of the heart contracting as a unit, guess what it does? It just kind of sits there and wrinkles around like that and pumps absolutely no blood whatsoever. We call that fibrillation. So fibrillation is when the electrical coordination of the heart has been lost. The heart is still contracting, but not as a unit, so it can't pump blood. So it's using up energy. It's not pumping blood to the brain. And when somebody's ventricles go into fibrillation and stop pumping blood, how much consciousness do you have in terms of time? I think we talked about this, because your brain uses a lot of ATP very fast. When oxygen can't get to the brain because blood is no longer being pumped, you have between 2 and 3 seconds worth of consciousness. Okay, when somebody goes into fibrillation, they pass out almost immediately. And then since these heart cells are working, they're contracting but not pumping blood, not getting oxygen, okay, then there's no blood still being pumped to the brain. The brain is going to die. How long does it take for somebody's brain to die when the heart goes into fibrillation? 2 to 3 minutes, right? So 2 to 3 seconds and a person loses consciousness, 2 to 3 minutes, and then there's brain death. And unfortunately, no one's ever figured out a way how to restart a brain once it has died, right? So death is one of these irreversible conditions. That's why it's really nice to be CPR certified, because if you are, you know how to make somebody's heart beat just from the outside, right? If their heart is not beating by themselves. How do you do that? What's that called? Yeah, CPR. What's the one part of CPR where you're actually beating somebody's heart? Yeah, chest compressions. When you do chest compressions, it's not to help them breathe. That's to compress the heart so that it helps pump blood. Now, how come blood doesn't flow when you do a chest compression? How come blood doesn't flow from the right ventricle up to the right atrium? They're valves. And these valves can operate just fine when you do chest compressions, right? Because they're just passive. They don't require muscle activity to work. And the same thing for the semilunar valves. They work too, just by pressure. So blood can flow out of the left ventricle into the aorta, but not the reverse. Okay. All right, so innervation, let me see if I got another slide right here on the conduction system of the heart. I think we covered it pretty much. But we do have another slide to look at, and that is innervation is not by the somatic nervous system, it's by the autonomic nervous system. And you just told me that the autonomic nervous system has how many divisions? There are two, right? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. And if you think of the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic, how would you describe the relationship between those two divisions? They're antagonistic to each other. So in terms of the heart, one will act like a gas pedal and the other will work like a brake pedal. And of course, you don't want to push on both at the same time because they'll counteract each other. But just like your car, if you use them properly, then you have precise control and balance over the speed of your vehicle. All right, the parasympathetic come from the medulla. There's a cardioregulatory center in the medulla that can send signals out through the vagus nerve to the SA node and to the AV node to slow it down. All right, so the parasympathetic nervous system slows the heart rate down via the vagus nerve. Sympathetic nerves get to the heart by going through the sympathetic chain ganglia. All right, so here's the preganglionic fiber going into the sympathetic chain, and then in the sympathetic chain ganglia at synapses, so here's the postganglionic fiber going to the nodal tissues as well as to the heart muscle itself. So the sympathetic nervous system can increase the heart rate by working on the SA node, but it also can increase the force of contraction. All right, so it can do two things. The parasympathetic nervous system can only change heart rate, but it can't make the heart weaker, which I suppose maybe is a good thing, because you wouldn't want your heart to get any weaker. It's okay maybe if your heart gets stronger on demand, but not necessarily a good thing to make your heart very weak. Okay, so that's it for the heart chapter, unless somebody has some questions. Layers of the heart. Oh, we didn't talk about layers of the heart. How many layers does the heart have? Three layers. Yeah, did anybody know the three layers? Started with superficial. Epicardium. Yeah, it's pretty routine. Epicardium, myocardium, endocardium. Right. Okay. That's pretty easy stuff. All right. That conduction system, I think, maybe seems really easy and simple to understand, but a lot of students just don't get it straight for an exam. So look at those figures a couple times. I'm sure that those are exam figures. And know how that signal flows. Know how that electrical signal flows. Okay, so let's go to next chapter. And the next chapter is going to be blood vessels. So let's look in here and in here. So chapter 20. Okay, so before I start talking about this slide right here, I want you to know that there are basically three kinds of blood vessels, three major kinds of blood vessels, and we talked about two of them already. There's a kind of blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart. What is that? That's an artery. Then there's a blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart, and that's a vein. And then you got something that's in between. All right, so, oh, I put those slides away. Let me get these out. And then there's something in between. Okay, and those things that are in between are these really small tubes right here, and they're very thin. These are what are called capillaries. So heart pumps blood into a tube we call an artery. It flows through capillaries into a vein, and then what does the vein do? Brings it back to the heart. Okay, blood flows back to the heart. So that's a typical kind of circulation. You have an artery, a capillary, and a vein. And when you look at an artery right here, does it look like it's really thin and kind of fragile, or does it look thick with a lot of layers and strong? It's thick and with a lot of layers. There's connective tissue layers, maybe some elastic tissue, and look, it also has muscle, has smooth muscle. So we're going to look at some arteries and understand some of these layers, and it's not just a exercise in futility, but a lot of disease happens in blood vessels. And it incorporates, or that disease process will affect different layers of a blood vessel. And to come up with a proper diagnosis, it's really nice to know what layers of a blood vessel are diseased and which ones are healthy. Because if you have a diagnosis, what can you do? You know how to treat it. And if you have a diagnosis, you also kind of know what the prognosis is going to be, which means the outcome, right? So that's important to know all of these different layers right here. Okay, and a vein has all the same kind of layers, but it's in a little bit different arrangement because the pressure in an artery is very high and a pressure in a vein is very low, and that's the reason why blood flows from an artery to a vein, because arteries have what kind of pressure? High pressure, and veins have low pressure, so blood is just going to want to flow from high to low pressure through these capillaries right here. All right, so let's take a look at some of these layers. in a blood vessel. All right, so there are three main layers. The tunica externa, that's a superficial layer, layer in the middle, tunica media, and then the inner layer, the tunica intima. And we see these layers on this diagram, and this I'm sure is an exam figure. All right, so the tunica externa, and a tunic just means like a covering or a coat, okay, or some kind of wrapping. And the tunica externa contains connective tissue, right, like collagen fibers, which makes it very strong so that these blood vessels generally don't like to stretch. Those collagen fibers are anchored to other parts of the body so these blood vessels don't move around inside your body. Right? And actually, some blood vessels have such a big, thick tunica externa. If we were to zoom in, I see there's even blood vessels inside of this layer of a blood vessel because those cells, these fibroblasts inside the tunica externa, need oxygen and nutrients and need to get rid of waste products. So do you see some red and blue dots in this layer right here? I'm using my imagination, but I can almost imagine them to be red and blue. Red and blue up over here. Those blood vessels that actually flow through a blood vessel to nourish a blood vessel is called a vasa vasorum, which we have right here. Vasa vasorum. And they're found only in large blood vessels because small blood vessels are so small, the blood inside of it can bring oxygen to the wall of the blood vessel, but not for big, thick ones like the aorta, for instance. Okay. So the next deepest layer, the middle layer, is the tunica media. It has smooth muscle that you see right here, so that smooth muscle can contract and it can withstand, it can contain the high pressure inside of this tube so that the blood will flow from an artery into a vein. And there's also elastic fibers, right, that I see right here. So some of these blood vessels not only have connective tissue and muscle, but it has elastic tissue so that when the heart pumps a bunch of blood into the aorta expands a little bit, and as the blood flows out of the aorta, what happens to the size of the aorta because of those elastic fibers? It goes back down to its normal size. So the aorta is kind of acting like a balloon, expanding and shrinking back down because of these elastic fibers. All right, so circular smooth muscle and that elastic connective tissue. And then the last layer, the deepest layer, is the tunica intima. And the deepest part of the blood vessel is called an endothelium. Kind of sounds like epithelium, but it's what? On the inside of a blood vessel. So we call it an endothelium. Just like the innermost layer of the heart. What's the innermost layer of the heart? That is the endocardium. Okay, so the endothelium is just a simple squamous epithelium, just like the endocardium is. And it performs the same kind of function as the endocardium in the heart. And that, what do you think the surface is like on the inside of a blood vessel? Remember, this is called the lumen. Right? What is this surface, this endothelium? You think it's nice and smooth and slippery, or it should be jagged and rough? Smooth and slippery, so blood flows over it without causing blood clots. Right? So the endothelium is very important for that reason. There's a subendothelial layer right here. Okay, and there's an internal elastic membrane as well, so this tunica intima can expand a little bit. This is where we see most of the disease in blood vessels. Hopefully it hasn't gotten into the smooth muscle yet. Okay, so that is an artery. Let's compare this with a vein right away. Look over here to a vein. It has three same layers, intima, media, and externa. The externa is almost as thick as on an artery. As a matter of fact, when you look at a vena cava in lab today, you'll see that the inferior superior vena cava kind of look like the aorta if you just look at this outermost layer. It doesn't need as much smooth muscle, so this layer is a little bit smaller. Okay, and the endothelium, okay, has little valves in it that poke up into the lumen of a vein so blood can flow from high pressure to relatively low pressure right above the valve, and when blood starts to flow back, guess what happens to these trapdoors? They close and prevents blood from going back into the extremity. It can only go back to the heart. As long as this blood vessel doesn't get dilated, pulled apart too much, right, and then the valve leaflets can't approximate each other, they can't touch each other, then that vein is going to be leaky. And that produces a condition that we call varicose veins. When a blood vessel just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and blood pools in somebody's leg as a result of that. That can also happen in deep veins within a leg or deep veins within somebody's body. So that's just another illustration of how important it is to know all of these different layers within the heart. Okay, so if we look at a vein, we see that it is thinner than an artery because it doesn't have as much smooth muscle. What's another difference between a vein and an artery? I see it on this slide right here. Valves, that's right. Arteries don't contain valves, but veins do. And as a matter of fact, on somebody that's thin, if they were to exercise their arm, they can see a vein right here in their arm. And if they were to block the blood return, I can see like little knots every once in a while in that vein. Guess what those little knots are? Especially if I try to force some blood back down into my hand. That's these valves catching that blood, okay, and backing the blood up, little valve veins. All right, so that's two of the three main kinds of blood vessel. Here's the third one, and this is what we call a capillary. And when we look at a capillary, all right, what can you tell me about the thickness of a capillary compared to an artery or a vein? Is it thicker, about the same thickness, or is it thin? It's thin. It's very thin. It's really, really, really thin. A capillary does not have a tunica externa, does not have a tunica media, so it doesn't have elastic tissues, doesn't have muscle tissues, doesn't have collagen tissues. It just has a little basement membrane, and as a matter of fact, even the tunica intima in an artery and a vein has elastic fibers, but not a capillary. The only layer within a capillary is the endothelium. All right, so a capillary is pure endothelium. That's it, and very, very thin, which means that this is the only kind of vessel where substances can enter the blood from your body. So a capillary is a site of exchange. And if something's in the blood, it's the only place where that substance can actually leave the blood. So compounds entering and leaving the blood can only occur in a capillary because it's thin. And some capillaries are kind of leaky as well. Most of the processes that allow material to move back and forth is controlled by a process we call diffusion, and diffusion works only through very small spaces or small distances, very short distances. So the distance from the lumen of a capillary to the extracellular space right here has to be very short or very close, and that is only in a capillary. Okay, that's why the CPR rules were changed not too long ago, because if we have oxygen in this artery right here, where can that oxygen go if the blood is not being pumped? So here we have a bunch of oxygenated blood in somebody's aorta and their heart stops and that blood can't move out of the aorta. What happens to that oxygen in the aorta? It just sits right there because it can't get out, right? But if you start to do chest compressions and move a little bit of that blood from the aorta into a capillary, guess what can happen? That oxygen can go into the tissues, right, and save that person's life. So now, when you do chest compressions and breathing, they change the ratio. More chest compressions compared to inhalations for somebody, because we want to move this blood that is loaded with oxygen to that patient's body. Right? So that's the most important thing. Get the blood circulating, because all of that blood that's in their arteries is fully oxygenated and ready to help them out and save their life. You just have to do some chest compressions. All right, so this is a really good exam figure, because you see the three kinds of blood vessels. Okay. All right, let's look at some subclassifications of blood vessels. So we got arteries, and of course you should know, let's see what I can do. If I go control plus, does that make it any bigger? Doesn't make it any bigger. View. Zoom. Let's try that. That might be easier to see. Might be too much. We'll see. All right, so an artery, again, the definition is what? Takes blood away from the heart. That's its job. Whether it's oxygenated or deoxygenated, it could be one or the other. And you should have an example in your mind of an artery that is low in oxygen and an artery that's high in oxygen. Okay? And as a matter of fact, let's maybe draw some arrows in your notes right here. Give me the name of an artery that's high in oxygen. Aorta, right? It's taking oxygenated blood to the systemic circulation away from the heart. And give me the name of an artery that is relatively low in oxygen or deoxygenated. The pulmonary artery is taking relatively deoxygenated blood, not through to the systemic circulation, but where is it taking that blood so that it becomes oxygenated once again? To the lungs, right? So as long as you get some sleep the night before, I think you can figure that out during a test even. All right, so arteries can be oxygenated or deoxygenated. It's an artery because it takes blood away from the heart. They have high pressure. Arteries have high pressure. That's why their walls are so muscular and have a lot of connective tissue. And arteries have a lot of elastic tissue in large arteries. We call these conducting arteries near the heart, like the aorta, for instance. All right, and a muscle layer in small and medium vessels. Right, because they don't have as much elastic tissue, we call these distributing arteries. They can change their size, right, by vasodilating or vasoconstricting. Vasodilating means getting bigger. Vasoconstricting means getting smaller. And then blood flow changes through a blood vessel as a result of that. And it's important to control blood flow throughout your whole body because that's what brings oxygen and nutrients to your body. So changing the radius, right? Changing the diameter of a blood vessel changes the flow through that blood vessel in a very astounding way. For instance, if we change the radius of a blood vessel by a factor of 2, going from 1 to 2, it doesn't matter what the units are, one might expect that the blood flow will change from 1 to 2 units. But the way that blood flow changes is that it goes from 1 to 16 times greater when the radius increases. And that's because of the fourth power rule. So the fourth power rule says if we change the diameter by a factor of 2, what about blood flow? It's 2 times 2, which is 4, times 2, which is 8, times 2, which is 16. So small changes in the diameter of a blood vessel means huge changes in blood flow through various organs. As a matter of fact, if we were to change the diameter of a blood vessel by a factor of 5, making it 5 times smaller or 5 times bigger, the flow would change by a factor of 625 because you have to multiply that 5 by itself 4 times because of the fourth power rule. So vasoconstriction or vasodilation is a way to control blood flow through different parts of your body. Okay, arterioles are small arteries. And they're specialized to regulate blood flow by, what's a very convenient process for controlling blood flow? Controlling the diameter of a blood vessel, making it bigger, we call that vasodilation. Making it smaller, we call that vasoconstriction. And this constriction or dilation could be under the control of the sympathetic nervous system. And you know something about the sympathetic nervous system, right? It's one half of what? The autonomic nervous system. Okay, but it also can be controlled by what we call local control. That is, when a tissue, tissues can secrete substances into the blood, and those substances can control vasoconstriction or vasodilation. For instance, when you start to exercise a biceps brachii, okay, what do you think is important? To cut off blood to that muscle or to increase blood flow to that muscle when it starts to exercise? Increase blood flow, okay? And does anybody know what compounds a muscle starts to secrete when it exercises? For instance, lactic acid, maybe you've heard of, okay? So when lactic acid builds up, it can go to these muscles at these precapillary sphincters and arterioles, cause them to dilate, and when they dilate, maybe they dilate by a factor of 2, what happens to blood flow in that muscle? It increases by a factor of 16. Okay, so when a substance is secreted by a tissue, okay, and it's not due to the nerves going to that tissue, but it's under the control of that tissue itself, we call that local control. All right, so a muscle, when it's exercising, is bigger and heavier because it has more blood because of local control. And lactic acid is just one of the compounds that builds up in a muscle that increases blood flow to that muscle. Okay, a precapillary sphincter. A sphincter should remind you of a certain kind of skeletal muscle. A sphincter is a circular, smooth muscle. So it means it's not under your voluntary control. It's under the control of your autonomic nervous system or local control. Right? What should that remind you of in terms of skeletal muscles? What's a circular skeletal muscle? We call that an orbicularis, right? Orbicularis oculi around your eyes, orbicularis oris around your mouth. All right, so a sphincter is just a smooth muscle that's circular, like an orbicularis. Okay, and these sphincters are under local control only at the precapillaries right here. So these are little gates that control blood flow through a capillary. So when this tissue here is highly metabolic, for instance, when a muscle is contracting, it's going to cause dilation of these precapillary sphincters, and then what's going to happen to blood flow when they dilate? Then blood will flow through these capillaries. But if this is a muscle and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, typically, what are your muscles like at 3 o'clock in the morning? Yeah, they're relaxed, right? Because you're sound asleep, they're not exercising. These precapillary sphincters are contracted because blood doesn't need to go to those muscles because they're not working. Okay, so that's under the local control. When blood gets into a capillary, there's a special function that can happen. So when blood's in a capillary, what can take place? That cannot take place in an artery or a vein. Exchange can take place, right? So oxygen can leave if it's a systemic capillary, CO2 can enter if it's a systemic capillary, and if this is a pulmonary capillary, which way is CO2 going to go? If this is a pulmonary capillary, carbon dioxide is going to be high in the blood, and then it's going to go into your lungs, and then what do? You breathe it out of your body. Okay, which way is oxygen going to go in a pulmonary capillary? It's going to be high in your lungs because you inhale oxygen. Okay, so there's high oxygen here, low oxygen in the blood, and a capillary is thin that allows for diffusion, so oxygen can enter the blood in this capillary. What about oxygen entering or leaving an artery? Can it happen? And why? It cannot happen because the wall of an artery is too thick, right? Only capillaries have thin walls. Okay. There are three kinds of capillaries in our body, and these are controlled by how tight the endothelial cells are joined together. So if we look at a capillary, and I see a capillary right here, how do I know this is a capillary and not an artery or a vein? Because it only has an endothelium. It doesn't have a tunica externa, tunica media, right? It's just one thin little membrane, these simple squamous endothelium right here, and a little bit of a basement membrane, maybe another cell here called a pericyte. And here's blood, here's a red blood cell. We've looked at these in lab. And a capillary is big enough for one red blood cell to squeeze through at a time. And that's about it. Because remember, diffusion only happens over very short distances. So there's the red blood cell carries oxygen. It can't be far away from the blood vessel wall, or oxygen won't be able to diffuse out. So these capillaries are very, very small. Okay, there are some spaces between the endothelial cells, and we call that an intercellular cleft. And that helps exchange, right? So here's a hole in the capillary that helps exchange both for fluids and other materials, can actually leave this intercellular cleft. And if it's a small space, we call this a continuous capillary. This is what you have in most parts of your body. Continuous capillaries. Good examples would be in skin and muscle. It's not a very leaky kind of capillary. This is the least leaky of all the capillaries. The next kind of capillary. Not only do we have intercellular clefts, but I see that we have some pores within the endothelial cells. So what happens to exchange? Does it increase or decrease when you go from a continuous capillary to a fenestrated capillary? It increases because this capillary is more leaky, because it has more holes in it. These little holes or pores are what we call fenestrations, or little windows. So this kind of capillary is what we find where we want even more exchange taking place. For instance, in the kidneys and small intestine, like in order kidneys to excrete urine, okay, small intestine to absorb nutrients that are in our digestive tract. These fenestrations aid in absorption. All right, so that's a second kind of cell, a capillary. And then here's the third kind of capillary. How do you think of this one in terms of leakiness? Very leaky, right? Because not only are there intracellular clefts, these intracellular clefts are really ripped apart, very incomplete connections between the endothelial cells. The fenestrations are huge. So this is the leakiest kind of capillary. We call this a sinusoidal capillary, the most permeable. This is what we find in liver and bone marrow and spleen. A lot of fluid leaks out through these kinds of capillaries. And even the basement membrane is incomplete. All right, so these are extremely leaky capillaries. But nonetheless, we still call that a capillary because it allows for exchange from the extracellular fluid to the blood. Okay, so this enhances exchange from stuff that's in the lumen of this capillary to the extracellular space. All right, so be familiar with those three kinds of capillaries. All right, where does blood flow after a capillary? What does it flow into? A vein. So here's a vein, and in particular, a small vein is what we call a venule. Right, so a tiny little vein is a venule, and when venules join together, we call that anastomose, right? When an artery breaks into two arteries, like I see right here, we call that a bifurcation, right? So when an artery splits into two, that's a bifurcation. When two veins come together, like here and here, this is what we call anastomosis, when veins join together. Not really a bifurcation because of the flow pattern. Anastomose means to join together as opposed to split apart. Okay, so this blood is added, the blood from these two veins are added together. Okay, so a venule is just a small vein, and then a vein is just a little bit bigger as a result of anastomosing with other small venules. And what's the definition of a vein? Yeah, it brings blood back to the heart. Okay, and it could be oxygenated or deoxygenated blood. All depends on what. I see two conditions right here. That kind of reminds me of left heart, right heart. So I think of two circulations. What kind of vein is high in oxygen? Are there any in the body? It seems strange, but what kind of vein is high in oxygen? The pulmonary vein. Yeah, coming back from the lungs, and that makes perfect sense, right? When blood is coming back from the lungs, it should be high in oxygen, so the pulmonary veins are high. And what about a vein that's relatively low in oxygen? Will be a vein in the systemic circulation, one that's bringing blood back from everywhere else in your body, like your brain and heart. And a good example would be the vena cava, bringing blood into the right atrium. Those are going to be low in oxygen. Okay. All right, and don't forget, veins have valves to prevent retrograde flow. And in order to move that blood from a vein to your heart, there still needs to be a pump involved with it somehow. And there are two kinds of pumps that I want you to know about that help venous blood return to the heart. Now let's see what we have right here. Oh, good. We got it really close. I don't want to flip through a lot of slides. Okay. Here we have the anastomosing of a number of veins into this one big vein right here. So these could be venules, blood flowing back. And let's just say some blood gets into this segment of this vein. Can it go back down to the part of the periphery where it came from? Can blood flow down to the bottom over here, what we call retrograde? Can this blood in this vein return to the tissue where it's coming from? No. You see no. You say no, and you see why? Because there are valves in these blood vessels. As long as this blood vessel is healthy, the valve will work just fine. Okay. So this blood vessel just happens to pass by a couple of muscles, right? And when these muscles contract, what happens to a muscle? They bulge. They get really big and thick, right? Okay. And so then they compress this chamber of blood, so the pressure increases because it's being squeezed by these two muscles, and blood will want to exit this chamber right here, but can it go down? Nope, it can only go up when this valve opens, and which way is that? That's toward the heart. Okay, so muscle activity, muscle contraction, is what we call the skeletal muscle pump, right? That helps return venous blood back to the heart. Okay, here's something that's pretty interesting. What kind of tissue is blood? I want to develop this a little bit. What kind of tissue is blood? It's a connective tissue, kind of a funky kind of connective tissue because it's not like bone, it's not like tendon. What kind of connective tissue is it? What are its physical properties? It likes to flow from one place to another by a pressure difference. It's a fluid connective tissue, right? Okay. And when it stops flowing, when blood stops flowing, which it's supposed to do all the time, if it stops flowing, it likes to turn into a solid. We call that coagulation. So if blood is not flowing through this vein, then it likes to form a thrombus. And then, of course, that's bad because that will block off this blood vessel. So how do you keep blood flowing through this vein right here? By muscle contraction. Okay? So as a matter of fact, that's a nice way to keep these veins nice and healthy. And even somebody who's your age or my age, if we were to hop on an airplane and fly to someplace really far away, maybe a 16-hour flight someplace, where do you have to go to fly 16 hours straight? Australia, maybe Denpasar in Indonesia, someplace really far away. Probably won't do that over Thanksgiving, maybe over Christmas. Okay, it's a good idea to do what? To get up out of your seat, walk around, and use some skeletal muscle to get blood flow circulating so that you don't get blood clots. And that happens to people every once in a while. And that actually happened to a news reporter in the Gulf War. He was really too anxious to get out of his Humvee or armored personnel carrier for about a week, and he just sat inside this armored vehicle, and a blood clot developed in a vein. It dislodged itself. And where does this blood go after this vein? Okay, to the heart. What part of the heart? Oh, this is a good exercise. What part of the heart? This is systemic circulation. Right atrium. From the right atrium, it moves past the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle. Then it passes through the pulmonary semilunar valve into the pulmonary artery, and then goes where? To the lungs. And as it goes to the lungs, what happens to the diameter of those blood vessels? They get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until they get to this microscopic level. And sooner or later, that blood clot, all right, gets trapped in one of these blood vessels. And it might be this big one right here. So we call that a pulmonary embolism. Pulmonary embolisms are very dangerous. Unless treated immediately, are fatal. All right, so a little bit of physical activity can go a long way in preventing pulmonary embolism, even in normal people such as yourselves. Because of the, what, the skeletal muscle pump for returning, oh, that was a nice picture, for returning blood to the heart, namely this right atrium right here. Okay, there's another pump that helps return blood to the heart. And that is something that changes the pressure inside your thorax. So a fluid will flow always from high pressure to low pressure. And there could be different kinds of fluid. A gas is a fluid and a liquid is a fluid. Both gases and liquids flow from high pressure to low pressure. All right. So when air is flowing into your lungs, where is there high pressure? Everything's going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. So when air is flowing in your lungs, where is there low pressure? In the room or in your lungs? There's got to be low pressure in your lungs, otherwise air wouldn't flow in. Okay. So your chest expands, air flows in because there's low pressure inside your thoracic cavity. Well, how do you get that air out? Okay, yeah, you just go like that. Duh, that's pretty easy. But how do we do that? We do that by pressurizing our chest, right? By compressing our chest, making the volume smaller. So the pressure inside our lungs increases above the pressure inside the room. So which way is air going to flow? If it's high inside your lungs and low in the room, it's going to flow out. That's right. It's going to flow out because of that pressure difference. And that pressure difference is adjusted by moving your rib cage and your sternum and your diaphragm. Okay. So, but that doesn't always or just work for air, it also works for blood. When you expand your chest and the pressure in your chest decreases so air flows in, what else is going to flow into your thoracic cavity? Blood from other parts of your body. So So you act like your thorax acts like a little vacuum cleaner, sucking blood back to your heart whenever you take a breath in. That helps return blood to your heart. We call that the respiratory pump. Okay? The respiratory pump is due to breathing, just changes in volume of your thoracic cavity. So it's almost the same kind of process as moving air in and out of your body. It's used to bring air, to bring blood to the heart, but breathing really doesn't help very much in pumping blood from your thoracic cavity when you're exhaling, because it requires a lot more pressure. Okay, so that is some introduction to physiology and anatomy of the circulatory system. And I think for the rest of the lecture of the circulatory lecture, we're going to pretty much just talk about structure. Okay, not so much the function anymore. All right, and so we're going to first start by talking about the pulmonary circulation. As a matter of fact, let's start with something a little bit, some of the concepts that we know about already. How many sides does the heart have? Two, right and left. How many circulations do you have in your body? You got two, yep. What are they? Pulmonary and systemic circulation. So let's talk about this pulmonary circulation first. Okay, so pulmonary circulation, let's say it starts here in the right ventricle. The right ventricle is pretty strong. It can pressurize that blood and squirt it up into the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery, right? And that will open the pulmonary semilunar valves right here. So now you have blood in the pulmonary trunk, and it's going to bifurcate into the right and left pulmonary arteries. And this blood is going to the lungs. For what reason? Yeah, gas exchange, in particular, what? To pick up oxygen and to get rid of CO2. So this blood right here has a certain color. And you should tell me what color that is. Blue. Okay, nice blue color. Which means low in oxygen. I didn't know if it was purple or pink or whatever color it was. Okay, so it's blue. I like that color. And so here we have blood that's low in oxygen going to the lungs. And an exchange is going to take place in the lungs. Now, why do we call this an artery, even though it's blue, even though this blood is blue, low in oxygen? Because it's just taking blood away from the heart. Exactly right. Okay, so here's the pulmonary artery, and then going to different lobes of the lungs. We have more bifurcations of the pulmonary artery. So even in the lungs, when I see these blue vessels, we know that this is what kind of blood vessel? Is it an artery or a vein? It's an artery. Yeah, don't get tricked on that. Okay, these are still arteries. And then it goes through capillaries. So here's a capillary. Here's a pulmonary capillary specialized for exchange, gas exchange. So oxygen goes from the air in your lungs into the capillary. CO2 that's high in the capillary goes into these air spaces in your lungs, and then you exhale it out. All right, and then that blood returns to the heart via what kind of blood vessel? What brings blood back to the heart? A vein. And the veins that we're talking about are the pulmonary veins, because we're talking about circulation to the lungs. And what color are the pulmonary veins going to be? The red, because why? They are oxygenated. So here we have all these pulmonary veins. They anastomose together to make the right and left pulmonary veins, bringing blood back to the left atrium. And it's still colored red because it's picked up oxygen in the lungs. So that's the pulmonary circulation. All right, so make sure you can answer these questions on the slide right here. Right pulmonary artery, is it high in O2 or high in CO2? The left pulmonary artery, high in oxygen, high in CO2. Make sure you can answer that. What happens in the capillaries? Exchange, you should know how exchange works. CO2 leaves, oxygen enters within the pulmonary circulation, and then it returns back to the heart via the four pulmonary veins, and you should know if they're high or low in oxygen. Okay, and to what part of the heart does it return to? The left atrium. All right, so that is the pulmonary circulation that we see on this slide right here. That's really nice. So anytime you in the lungs, if you see a blue blood vessel, it is an artery. If you see a red blood vessel, it's a vein. And because you know exchange takes place inside the lungs. Okay. That takes us to the next circulation, and that is the systemic circulation, which takes blood everywhere else except to the lungs. Right? Away from the heart, to your head, away from your heart, to your big toe, to your arm, to your little finger, everywhere, to your kidneys. Right? This is the systemic circulation. And what color are these blood vessels? Yeah, I knew that. Okay, they're red because that signifies what? They're high in oxygen. Because these blood vessels, the systemic arteries, will deliver oxygen to your tissues to stay alive. All right, that's why they're colored red. All right, so let's just look at a couple of these blood vessels right here. So I'm going to just zoom in maybe to this region right here. Okay, so here we see the heart. Here's that nice anterior longitudinal sulcus, the apex, the base. The left ventricle is pumping blood past the aorta, aortic semilunar valve into the ascending aorta that we see right here. And then we see the arch of the aorta. And then after the arch, we have the descending aorta all the way down to here, which I'm not going to scroll down to. This is all descending aorta. The part that's in the thoracic cavity, meaning the part that's superior to the diaphragm, this is what we call the thoracic aorta. Can't see it very well because it's behind the heart. And this part of the aorta, which is still descending aorta, is what part of the aorta? What part of the descending aorta? Abdominal aorta. Right, so the descending aorta is made of abdominal as well as thoracic aorta. Okay, let's look at the first branches off the aorta. It's a nasty, tricky question. Okay, because I see a branch right here, but is that the first branch off the aorta? And you know what? I heard some no's, and that's really good because the heart itself is part of the systemic circulation. It needs blood supply in order to stay healthy, right? And you have the left and right coronary arteries branching off of the ascending aorta. I'll find a nice picture to show you. So the first branches off the aorta are the coronary arteries bringing systemic blood, which is what, high or low in oxygen? High in oxygen to the heart, indeed, because the heart's an exercising muscle constantly. It needs oxygen. Then you have the ascending aorta, then the arch. What's the first branch off the arch of the aorta? It's called brachiocephalic trunk, or you could call it brachiocephalic artery. And very early on, it's going to branch into two other, all right, or bifurcate into two other arteries. One that goes underneath the clavicle. We would like to call that the subclavian. That's really easy to remember, that one. And then the other branch takes blood to the head. And that is what we call the common carotid artery, common carotid artery. And that's a very important one, bringing blood to the brain and everywhere else on the head. So that's the job of the brachiocephalic on the right side of the body. All right, what are the next branches on the arch of the aorta? I see three. So I don't see any nice bilateral symmetry right here. It's kind of funny. I see three. I would expect maybe to see four blood vessels, but I see three. The next one is taking blood to the left side of the head. So that's the common carotid on the left side, doing the job of the right common carotid on the right side. And the third branch off the arch of the aorta is the left subclavian. So right and left does make a little sense because there's some asymmetry in the body. So the brachiocephalic trunk is doing the job of what two blood vessels? The left common carotid and the left subclavian. So the brachiocephalic is like the right, is the right common carotid and the right subclavian joined together. That's why we call it brachiocephalic. Okay, and then when a blood vessel moves into the armpit region, we call that the axillary, and then when it moves into the arm, we call that the brachial artery. Okay, let's maybe look a little bit more at this. Okay, I want to take a look at all the slides available. I lost them. Okay, let's look in the head. All here. This is what I'm wanting to see. Maybe let's start right here. Okay, so here we see a nice heart, apex, base, anterior longitudinal sulcus. What's the most anterior blood vessel coming off the base of the heart? Pulmonary trunk, right? You should just memorize that and ingrain it in your mind. And then posterior to that is the aorta. Okay. And the first branch off the arch is the brachiocephalic. The next one is the left common carotid and left subclavian. Okay, and then the brachiocephalic on the right side bifurcates into the right common carotid and the right subclavian. So this is where I want to start looking next on this slide here. So here's that brachiocephalic trunk. Here's the common carotid. Here's the subclavian. The first branch off the subclavian, I think you'll enjoy seeing this. All right, I see some bones in the neck, some vertebrae in the neck. What kind of vertebrae are these? Yeah, cervical vertebrae. And what's a special feature of a cervical vertebrae? It has these vertebral foramina in the transverse processes. And look what's going through those transverse processes, through those vertebral foramina, is the vertebral artery. See the vertebral artery right here? Vertebral artery goes through those transverse processes, and that helps bring blood to the brain. All right, so that's one kind of blood vessel. Another blood vessel that brings blood to the brain comes from the carotid artery. So here is the common carotid, and it bifurcates in your neck, and it bifurcates to an external and an internal carotid. All right, so here is the internal carotid. Here's the external right here. External brings blood to everything outside the cranium. The internal carotid brings blood to your, it's got to be your favorite organ. That's your brain, right? Okay, so this right here, there's a little, and your book does a pretty poor job of mentioning this structure, so I want to mention it in particular. This bifurcation between the common carotid bifurcating into the external and internal carotid, we call this the carotid sinus. And it kind of looks like a little bulge or bulb right here. And it's probably one of the most imaged parts of any human's body because it forms a disease process. It forms plaques that like to break off, right? And then if it breaks off, where are those plaques going to go? They're going to go right to the brain. And those plaques then get into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller blood vessels. And then what happens? They get trapped and will plug up that blood vessel, cutting off blood supply to that part of the brain. And guess what we call that? A stroke. Yep, that's a stroke. Okay, if that happens to the heart, we call that a heart attack. If that happens to the lungs, we call that a pulmonary embolism. All right, but a stroke is a very devastating kind of disease process. A lot of times it develops from this carotid sinus right here. So I want you to know carotid sinus. The carotid sinus is also important because it has pressure receptors in it. This is one part of the body that can measure your blood pressure. And your blood pressure should be regulated so that you don't pass out or so your blood pressure doesn't go so high that it will blow up a blood vessel. Right? The pressure receptors are in the carotid sinus as well. And so, as a matter of fact, sometimes if you grab somebody's neck really, really hard and squeeze this part of the blood vessel, the carotid sinus, then the carotid sinus feels like your blood pressure is skyrocketing, is going way, way up, and it's sending signals to the brain, namely the medulla that I just showed you. And if the medulla thinks that your blood pressure is going way high, what decision will it make? It will say, hey, we better get your blood pressure down so that you don't blow up a blood vessel. It sends signals to the heart to slow down in contraction, okay, and get weaker, and guess what happens? Somebody can actually pass out. And that's sort of the basis of a sleeper hold. Or if you're doing surgery in this area, you got to be really careful. If you're doing surgery, for instance, that you don't stimulate those receptors because it could stop somebody's heart as a result of that. So carotid sinus is really important. So remember, sinus can be filled with all kinds of different things, like the nasal sinuses have air in them. The carotid sinus has blood. All right, so we're going to start with this slide next time on Wednesday. But the sign-in sheet is going around. Okay, make sure you sign this sign-in sheet. And we're going to finish off all the rest of the blood vessels. So you might want to look at this slide a little bit too. That will help you in lab. So let's see if we were recording. I hope we were recording. Indeed we were.